This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1963, the Durham School Board extended desegregation of schools to the youngest kids in the system, elementary students. Third grader Charmaine McKissick and her brother Floyd McKissick Jr. were two of the first African Americans to integrate North Durham Elementary School. Now, for some students, that act might have been exceptional. But for Charmaine, being the first African-American to do something like that wasn't unusual in her family. It was the norm. Charmaine and Floyd Jr. were following in the footsteps of their grandfather, who served in America's first black artillery unit, and their father, Floyd Sr., who was the first African-American to gain admission to UNC Law School. Charmaine's older siblings had integrated Durham High School and Carr Junior High School a few years earlier. That was before she and Floyd went to North Durham Elementary. Growing up in a house of civil rights leaders, Charmaine was intimately engaged in the movement from an early age, often participating in picket lines and protests as a young child. As a teenager, she loved the stage and was a singer and actress. She realized that she also had a talent for the art of communication. She went on to build a successful career in media. She established a mass communication department at Bennett College and North Carolina Central University. Today, she's a professor at NCCU, and she is working on a book documenting her father's work, and in particular, her father's vision for Soul City, a planned community in Warren County. Charmaine McKissick Melton joins me now. Charmaine, good to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Let's go back to your childhood. You were the youngest of your siblings. Tell us some of your earliest memories.
Earliest memories of the civil rights movement, I assume, are just stuff around the house, too, because almost all of it's related.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone recently to say that my mother used to jokingly call it the do drop in, because anyone might come in at any period of time. There was one Christmas Eve. We had a Asian American, I believe, from San Francisco, Moon, and Ike, who was from Louisiana. He is an African American male, about 300 and some pounds. Moon stayed about 2 weeks. Ike stayed from Christmas Eve until June 6th. I'm sure my brother remembers that. It was bunk beds. Ike was on the lower bunk. And it's one of those things where you just gave that bottom mattress away. There was a kind of indentation there. So I make fun of some of the things. But, I mean, looking back now, you know, 50-ish years later, some of them are comical. But there were also scary times, too.
Well, I guess there's a great story about your dad inviting everybody. We're jumping ahead here. Everybody back home. And
yeah,
your mom finding out about it a little late.
He tended to be a really gregarious, outgoing person. I guess fruit doesn't fall too far from the tree. And we would frequently plan for large groups of people to eat at the house or something for some purpose. In this case, it was, they believe the core convention happened to be, the national convention happened to be in Durham that year. I can't remember, 65 maybe, 60, something like that. And we had envisioned about 50 of the leaders from the community would come. But my father got up at our home church, which is right down the street from, up the street actually, from where we lived, Union Baptist Church on Roxborough Street here in Durham, and he invited the entire congregation. And my brother looked at me and I looked at him and we're like, he invited everybody. Oh my God, we've got to go run. So literally we ran down, we were in a balcony, ran down the back steps, run home to mom, said, he invited, no, he did not. Yes, he did, mom. No, he did not. Anyway, so she sent us with a few dollars in each direction to the local little convenience stores, and I went to Womble's and he went up the street the other direction, and we bought lots of saltines and Vienna sausage and like anything that you could pick up with your hands. Yeah. And so what was going to be a luscious chicken casserole with water chestnuts and I think asparagus and so forth, yeah, which was really tasty, it turned into hors d'oeuvres on crackers.
Yeah,
hundreds of people in and out, tromping through the house. So.
You talked about CORE, of course, the Congress on Racial Equality. Your father was president at one time. The civil rights movement, as you said, was central to your childhood and, of course, your career and his career. What was it? I mean, so you grew up in that. That was the water you drank and the air you breathed. Were you aware of the fact that something very big was happening as a little girl?
Big in the respect that I knew that people called my dad, and this is what I would hear, Lawyer Kissett, Lawyer Kissett. All I knew was what they were trying to say was Lawyer McKissick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All I knew was Lawyer Kissett was kind of somebody important. Because everybody wanted to have a minute of its time. Like I say, he was a really extrovert and fun-loving guy. So, but no, we also had one of my fondest memories and something I hoped I could do myself when I had children. We attempted. We didn't quite make it, which was to have dinner together every single day. So it was kind of my job after a certain point where I would pick up the phone around 5:30, quarter of six, call my dad, kind of remind him to kind of start making his way home from the office, even if he had to go back for an hour or two later and work. And we all sat home for dinner every day, pretty much at 6 p.m. Like, for instance, the Sunday dinners, people like Jesse Jackson would come because he'd be coming in from A&T and hanging out with my dad on a Sunday or whatever. So, you know, I've known him since I can remember pretty much. So those kind of, you know, things. But, yeah, that family meal gave us the ability, I believe, to discuss just about anything.
Well, and the fact that he was a lawyer was extraordinary. He had to sue to gain entrance to UNC Law School, right?
Correct. Before my birth, actually.
Yeah. But it was crucial. And I guess part of the history of Durham is the fact that people like your father were making a supreme effort to gain those professional spots. There was a middle class here, a black middle class, which made it an important stop in that moment in the civil rights movement.
Oh, absolutely. Right? I mean, even now you can go to Perry Street, downtown Durham, and talk about the concept of, you know, Black Wall Street,
right?
And how, you know, we had, growing up as a kid, now I should say that my father grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. What I would say is my mother grew up with a silver spoon in her mouth. Mm-hmm. Even though her parents were, you know, basically common laborers, her father was head of the Asheville, North Carolina Country Club. So she lived a very, very fine and high life. And my father, eventually, his family moved up to a point where they could move to that side of Asheville. So they ended up living on the same street as kids. So the point I'm making is that the fact that when we grew up, we kind of always knew that we were a little different. It wasn't so much that, I don't think it was a classes issue for us. I think, remember, I'm the youngest of four. And my oldest sister graduated from high school, which was Durham High, one of the first. Her and Larry Scurlock were the first African Americans to sue, integrate, and graduate from Durham High School in June of 1960. So when she graduated from high school, I graduated from kindergarten.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So great little age difference there. So it's as though I really don't remember people not being politically or active in my family. I have stories about being up at Royal Ice Cream and seeing, you know, the man calling me the N-word, driving a big pickup truck with a gun rack in the back and yelling out, "What's that little doing on the picket line?"
Yeah, well, and you were Royal, of course, the Royal Ice Cream. That was essentially one of the first sit-in, or one of the very first sit-ins.
Absolutely.
Long before Nashville and before even the Woolworths in Greensboro.
1957.
So tell us that story, because I know that you can fast forward. How old were you when you were on the picket line and heard that truck driver call your name?
I can't think I was more than four or five.
All right.
I think people think, oh, my God, there was such a big political statement that she was on the picket line. I mean, the reality was there was a lot of stuff to picket. Most things were segregated.
Yeah.
My mother had, I believe at the time, a station wagon. So we would keep picket signs in the back. I mean, it was a part of a normal activity that on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, you know, kids would come to our house and we'd go to the basement of St. Joseph's Church or some other church in town, and work on the picket signs. They were going to say the same kinds of things, whether it was Woolworths, A&P Grocery Store, or, you know, Royal Ice Cream.
Well, you also watched as your mother would take your sister to Carr Junior High School. I mean, tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a very vivid memory for me, and probably one of my most earliest memories for me, and negative. Andre was at Carr Junior High, and we would drop Jocelyn didn't seem to have as many problems. We dropped Jocelyn off at the high school, and then travel back around, because I think it was a few minutes difference in terms of what time school started, to the junior high. And every single day for months on end, I'm four, sitting in the front seat with my mom, and we let Andre out the back door, and she walks up to the school, and every single day the kids stand at the door and hold it shut. Every single day my mother would have to drive around, go park, go in the front door, go and see the principal. I mean, it was just one of those, really, really, people? Is it that deep? But I do remember thinking how frustrating that was for my sister. And one of the other things I remember about Andre is that there was a policy in place that a lot of people probably don't remember, that when you transfer from one school to another school, you were able to maintain whatever your memberships were, like the Honor Society or in the band or orchestra. And Andre was a majorette. And they wore short dresses, real short, and little white boots, for those who remember back in the day, with the big pom-pom puffs. All of a sudden, that rule got kicked to the curb. And my personal opinion is Durham could not quite could take seeing a black girl throw her pretty legs up in the air the same way they could others. So from that moment forward, Carr Junior High never, ever had a marching band. There's stories like that that I could talk about a lot, and people say, no, no, and I've documented and gone back myself and now as an academician to do the research. Just like someone on the school board told me, there's no such thing as ever having a swimming pool at what is now Durham School of the Arts, which was then Durham High School. I said, oh, absolutely, there is. And of course, I found it and talked to one of the superintendents. I have pictures and video. It was closed. It's now a part of the boiler room.
It was closed when it became integrated.
Black people and white people. Oh, we couldn't be in the same body of water. Oh, my God, we might catch something or whatever. I don't know where their brain was. But there are plenty of stories like that. I mean, you know, my brother and I even did a couple of those little minor things even at the elementary school.
I want to hear more of those stories as my conversation with Charmaine McKissick-Melton continues. She is now a professor of mass communication at North Carolina Central University. We'll get more of her story on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest today is Charmaine McKissick-Melton. She's a professor of mass communication at North Carolina Central University. We're talking about growing up here in Durham. You were picketing Royal Ice Cream Shop, always at the center. Your father, Floyd McKissick Sr., once president of the Congress and Racial Equality Corps. So that was a part of your life. What kind of messages were you getting at home? I mean, how clearly you're watching your mom try to take your sister to school and meeting all this kind of resistance. Were there talks? Were there discussions about where this was leading and how you should behave?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that pretty much anybody involved in the movement got the same knowledge base from the Highlander schools, which, of course, based, you know, and you can look at some of the Eyes on the Prize videos and things that talking about the whole nonviolent perspective and taking people through sort of a training role-playing process. So when you're called the N-word, you don't go off the deep end and you remain nonviolent. So we were, of course, talked about all those kinds of things at home, but also things such as, you know, why are we doing this? Why would we step out there? And I think this generation doesn't quite get what we were doing to a certain degree. It wasn't just about Charmaine or the McKissicks. It was the fact that we felt an obligation to show that our people are just as smart, just as bright, just as whatever descriptor you want to use. Because certainly segregation did not provide that as a common basis of knowledge. I was talking previously about some of the things we did. So as an example, my parents would never allow us to go to segregated facilities, certainly not an eating facility. That was absolutely out. I think they never wanted to have us feel that level of degradation. So they would perhaps get a takeout meal from somewhere and we would go home. But we would never sit in a segregated facility. Now, Floyd and I actually did go to the movies at the Regal on Pettigrew Street. And that was a segregated facility. But it was segregated, I guess, by not choice since it was owned by African Americans. So we were fortunate in Durham to be able to, in Floyd and I's era, to actually not need the services of white people too much. You know, our doctor was black. Our dentist was black, in fact. So there was very little. I mean, we have Mechanics and Farmers Bank, right. a black bank, a mutual savings and loan. It goes on and on for the city of Durham. There was a donut shop. Hey, we had a better donut shop than the one you got at downtown. our donuts are better. So there was never, I never felt a need to go sometimes in those places that were segregated because in Durham, we pretty much had whatever we needed on the black side that were owned by African-Americans.
Which makes the risk all the more impressive, it seems to me, if all of that's true. And even the schools, I mean, we're not going to call them equal, but they were, you're getting a pretty good education, even though nobody's going to argue for segregated schools. All of those things being true, there's a certain amount of risk involved in being active in this movement that your father took.
And absolutely.
What about you as kids? I mean, did they talk about that, or do you think he and your mom had conversations about having kids and making them part of this movement?
Well, I don't think any of us as kids were forced to do anything. Yeah. We just happened to be kind of the right age, guinea pigs, to do whatever. And we were all asked if we wanted to be involved and participated. So I think we could have said no, absolutely. But again, it was this obligation to your people to show the world that we are just as whatever. Mm. So a lot of the conversations at home were more about the logistics of how to deal with, if they call you this word, how to respond. You know, don't, as I said to Dr. King, this is the true story, as I said to him, about 2 years into this integration process in Durham, and I'm now gone from the third grade to the fifth grade, and I'm thinking, whew, okay, I actually said, you know, it's getting kind of hard to keep turning those cheeks. I think I'd like to do something else. And actually, my parents got to a point where they allowed me to be verbally a little more assertive instead of docile.
What did he say to you when you...
He said, you know, the classic analogy of, well, you're doing it not just for yourself, but for your people. Yeah. And some people have to sacrifice. I mean, that was the, I can't remember verbatim, but that was the essence of the words.
So speaking of Dr. King and these messages, powerful messages, the March on Washington comes along. Your father's going to be there, but he decides that you should not be there.
Yeah, well, yes, he did. But that's because the organizers, A. Philip Randolph in particular, who was a good friend of Dad's, had suggested children not come because in so many other situations in the South in the previous years, there had been some serious violence. And so they suggested that maybe you shouldn't bring young children along. So my older siblings went, but we didn't. And so we sat at home and watched it on TV and was ready to kill. You know, there's so many kids there. It's like, well, I don't believe we're missing this, Floyd. It's hard to believe. I mean, we'd pretty much been on a whole lot of stuff. And then later on, a few years later, you know, when James Meredith had decided to do a remarch of his integration of University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, we were there for the Meredith March on Mississippi in 1966, the entire family. And we're all much older people. So we're like, I don't believe we missed the March on Washington. But of course, it's now become a famous story. And you can see my little blurb on PBS talking about how Floyd and I missed the 1963 March on Washington. But really, the most ironic piece is we never expected to see our dad on TV. And he wasn't supposed to be a speaker, but Jim Farmer, who was the head of court at the time, was actually in jail, and again, with the movement. And so he couldn't quite get back to D.C. in time. So they went to their second command, which was my dad.
And so. Here's a little bit of the speech he made that day.
If we can solve our problems and remove the heavy heel of oppression from our neck with our methods, then man has no problems anywhere in the world which cannot be solved without them. So we are fighting not only for our rights and our freedom, we are fighting not only to make our nation safe for democracy it preaches, we are fighting also to give our old world a fighting chance for survival. Some of us may die, like William L. Moore or Medgar Evers, but our war is for life, not for death, and we will not stop our demand for freedom now.
Floyd McKissick Sr. making his speech at the March on Washington in 1963. His daughter, Charmaine McKissick Melton, is my guest this hour. What was it like for you to watch that on TV?
Pretty exciting because we didn't expect to see him as be a keynote speaker. And as I've said previously, I think Floyd feels the same way. I don't know if we talked about that in depth at the time, but it seemed like a much more staid, pat speech than his normal sort of fiery, you know, Baptist minister, really go at it. I've actually been told, I haven't researched this to the fullest, but I've been told that those were actually the words that Jim Farmer was going to speak, and that Dad did them instead for him, which would make plenty of sense to me now, because they didn't quite sound like him.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you're speaking somebody else's words, hard to put your whole self into it, even though those words make a lot of sense. Your dad promised your mom he would not take the leadership role in Corps. How'd that go?
Not too well. there was a little discussion about, you know, the fact that CORE was moving in different directions. I mean, CORE, I think, of the Civil Rights Organization was probably, from the very beginning, the most integrated. So was the NAACP, but maybe CORE was the most, you know, diverse. I think it was taking some change in direction, and my dad promised my mom that he would not accept the position, and then we turn on the 6 o'clock news, and anybody old enough to remember, Walter Cronkite came on and said, "So today, CORE has elected Floyd McKissick as the national director of CORE." And I turned and said, "Hey, Ma, we're moving to New York." And, of course, the answer was yes down the road.
What was that? Was that difficult? Was that a difficult transition for the family?
Interesting transition. I have noted in some of the writing I've been working on this summer that, and I do a little bit of narrative in introducing some of the speeches I'm working on that he wrote. I say that I remember writing on my sheet of paper, just like kids do, I wrote 6-6-66, the day I actually left Durham and moved to New York City. Has no double entendre meaning for those who have some deep, dark, whatever.
Not as evil as it sounds.
No, not as evil as it sounds. It just happens to be, you know, June the 6th. And we just happened to leave town. The day was the last day of school in that particular school year. Not, you know, nothing special. But I remember it, and we moved from Roxborough Street in a nice big house to a brownstone on 149th Street in Harlem. And my father was radical in respect that he moved the CORE office, which was in the Wall Street, Canal Street area, to 135th Street above Small's Paradise Bar and Lounge. Radical move. His perspective, I think, at the time, and we discussed it, was the fact that he felt he should be amongst his people. Mm-hmm. And Harlem was the place that needed that influx of energy, flow, money, so forth. So we ended up living, you know, 149th, just a few blocks away from 135th, where his office was.
What was it like going from, everybody knew you as the lawyer's daughter, right? Lawyer McKissick's daughter.
Yeah, Lawyer McKissick's daughter. Yeah.
And now you're going to New York. I mean, was that a big change for you?
I was so happy in respect that, oh, great, nobody's going to know me. You know, I'm just blending amongst the millions of people. And then there was a teacher strike. And my father was, of course, outspoken, as always. And this particular case, he was not necessarily supporting all of the teachers' perspectives. Mm. Yes and no. You have to look at it in great depth. Bottom line, he was on TV for about a week. And so I went from getting straight A's to straight D's. So we moved me to private school for a year or so. But I ended up going back to public school. My brother actually ended up graduating from that school, which is Walden, a very famous school in New York. Yeah. I ended up going to LaGuardia High School of Music and Art.
And is that where you developed your interest in the arts, or had you already?
I had always done that here in Durham. I was always dancing for, no one probably remembers her now, but Betty Brown was here at the time, and that was a little jazz and ballet and a little bit of everything. So I learned everything I could here. I'm trying to remember what the other organization was, the Allied Arts, I believe, which was like the precursor to the Arts Council. So I would take pretty much all of that. I did a lot of work in terms of piano when I lived here and won awards and so forth. And the voice, well, I think that was just, I just bugged the pastor of Union Baptist Church, and I just couldn't understand why the kids didn't have a choir. And so I became one of the founders, along with Psyche Davis, the Tots Choir at Union Baptist Church. So I've kind of always been a little extrovert and, you know, yeah, sure, yeah, stage.
Were you hoping to have a career?
I actually did pretty well when I was in New York. Yeah. Way back in the day, like when I was 13, I was making $5 an hour singing and dancing and modeling. I worked for Graysdale Marco Modeling Agency. I had a free scholarship for the Theodore School of Charm. And, again, I went to LaGuardia High School of Music and Art. So many kids there are already in that vein. And they would really good about allowing you to, you know, exercise your freedom. So if you needed to model somewhere or dance somewhere or sing somewhere, we had flexibility in our schedule to be able to accommodate that, because they knew many people. My original goal was to go to Juilliard, and then, of course, my dad decided to think about something called Soul City, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I moved from a brownstone in New York City to a mobile home on a dirt road in Soul City in Warren County, North Carolina.
Well, tell us about that move. You went to, you finished high school there, I guess,
I did.
Right?
I did most of my senior year. I'll make that one real quick. So first and second grade right here at W.G. Pearson, and then across town integrating at North Durham for third, fourth, and fifth. Sixth grade in New York, one school. Seventh grade, another school. Eighth grade, another school. Oh, ninth grade, another school. 11th grade, another school. And 12th grade, another school. So yeah. And I moved to North Carolina, I believe, at the end of the beginning of junior year or something like that. So I joked with my class yesterday to say that I was always an extrovert, but it certainly made me more of one because you kind of knew you might not be here more than a year, so you better hurry up and make some friends.
Quick, or not at all.
Exactly.
Well, you did go to UNC then.
I did. I went to undergrad at Chapel Hill and majored in radio, TV, film with a minor in speech and went right on to get a master's at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, the middle of the cornfields. Again, speech communication, specializing in radio, TV, film. And then I came back to this market and eventually became sales manager for WDUR and Foxy Radio. And then again in sales at WTVD Channel 11. So my primary passion is sales, the money end of the industry.
That is where the money is, certainly. But I want to hear about Northern Illinois. What was that experience like? Because that had to be, obviously, Harlem's one place, the South, Durham. Northern Illinois.
I don't have a transition issue. My biggest issue was the weather. And people kept saying, but didn't you live through a blizzard in New York? And I'm like, yeah, but this Midwest thing is a whole nother ballgame. I now know what that, the lake effect. That's another. Yep. That's a whole nother ballgame. I actually was in grad school there and worked at McDonald's. And I joked that I was frostbitten in places I didn't know you could be. But I also heard on the radio one day, it's in February, it's been 24. No, the high for the week has been 24 below zero.
Yeah.
And I thought, why? Why stay here?
Who lives here? Let's all move.
And so I had been moving a little bit faster than most. I never thought I'd ever teach. Ironic now that I look at it. But so I just kind of said to the master's program, look, let me just move at my own pace. So I came in August. I left in August. And I gathered that I raised a little ruckus because they told me that no African-American nor no female had done that in that record time.
Wow.
It was almost as though a sort of a double dare, like, you really can't do that, can you? And then we got into a major debate because they claimed that the information in the paperwork said that it needed to be this by that date and blah, blah, blah. And, being Floyd's daughter, I said, well, those things were not in place when you gave me my catalog when I walked in the door in August. So all I know is throughout all my yelling, screaming, and probably a little profanity, when I left in August, I got my degree in December. All I can tell you is it says August.
Well, so again, the struggle continues. And then you talked about getting in sales. That was where your heart was. But again, you were breaking ground, right? You were among the first African-Americans there and really had to sort of do some consciousness raising, I guess.
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. More than I actually anticipated.
Yeah.
One of my first part-time jobs was working at Carmichael Advertising Agency, primarily because they were there. One of their clients was Soul City. But one of their largest clients was the North Carolina Zoo and Wachovia. So they were the largest ad agency, quite frankly, in the state at the time. And Billy Carmichael and I had several really good discussions. And he's the one that pushed me, quite frankly, in the direction of sales. We also had conversations about the name of Soul City and whether it should be changed for marketing purposes. And now looking back a number of years, I can understand the problems, let's say.
Yeah.
But my response at the time was, well, there's a Whiteville. what's the problem with Soul City?
Yeah.
But going into sales, I won't call any station letters because they're all still in existence around here. But many people, why would you want to do sales? Because I think I'm going to be good at it and I can make you a lot of money. And at the time I walked in the door, there were very few women and certainly not any black women. There were very few black men. I was offered a job at one very prominent station in this market on air with no air experience whatsoever. I guess I looked the right color at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a joke, but but it's true. In the 70s, when they started to bring African Americans on the air, you couldn't be too light so that we couldn't figure out who you were, and you couldn't be too dark. So I guess I kind of fit somewhere in the middle there. And so I was offered the job, and I was downright really frustrated and appalled. that you would be willing to take a gamble on me to go on air and fluff up instead of working with, at the time and still is, most people who own large businesses and spend lots of money in advertising tend to be, forgive me, OWM, old white men.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have never had a problem, in terms of dealing with them, because for me, it's all about the money. If I can show you how to make money with my product, then you'll buy.
Well, did you have any influence in suggesting that there were also black men and women who had money to spend, and you're missing some opportunities?
Absolutely,
out here,
right? Particularly when I was in sales manager at WDUR and Foxy. I never forget the time I went to Atlanta to work with one of our reps. And I won't call any names there either, because they're still in existence. But he would go in and kind of forgive my language here, but sort of beg for the few pennies for this old-time black radio. And after the first call, I said, hey, let me pitch the next time. And mine was exceptionally different. I'm from the Triangle. It's up and growing. Do you know about the African-American population? These are black people that are not necessarily from the hood, but you know what? Doesn't matter. These are African-Americans who have had money for generations, businesses for generations. I go a little bit about the Black Wall Street, talk about North Carolina Central, all the other schools in the area, and just explain to them there's a great deal of disposable income with this demographic, and if you're missing them in the Triangle, you're missing a huge chunk of money that could be coming your way. Worked great with Delta Airlines, worked great with Coca-Cola. People began to see the light. But it was a educational process. And then, of course, there's the famous one where I went to the National Association of Broadcasters meeting, the Triangle Association. Everyone at the table, there were only general managers and sales managers. Everyone at the table was a white man. So when I got there, my boss, the general manager, didn't even have a chance to introduce me, and they asked, is this your girl? As in, like, secretary or administrative assistant. And, of course, he said, no, I'm the sales manager. All mouths dropped. You know, I still think about that, and, like, that was so unique. That was so different.
What year?
78, maybe? Yeah. 79? Yeah. Somewhere in that ballpark.
I'm talking to Charmaine McKissick-Melton today on The State of Things. Our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Charmaine McKissick-Melton, professor of mass communication at North Carolina Central University. We've mentioned Soul City several times already. Tell us more about that, your father's vision. What was it? Where was it? And we'll talk about how it evolved.
Okay. Well, I'll go back a little further and say that when he left CORE, he established something called McKissick Enterprises in New York City. And the goal of that was globally black economic development. And there were a lot of different projects at the time. The largest non-educated position in New York City was like for a butcher. So they started, many different things. Thunder and Lightning Publishing Company, a black publisher, a bunch of different things. One of those entities that jumped out of there on 125th Street across from the Apollo was this concept of a new town that would be equal and open to all. And so as they fleshed it out, it became Soul City, North Carolina, a place that was proposed to 50,000 people, planned and developed over a period of 20 to 30 years. It will not be what it was proposed to be. My frustration is that many people continue to say it was a failure. And so my angst with that is the fact that it was an exceptionally poor county. When the land for Soul City was bought, which is December of 69, so long, long time ago. It's still one of the poorest counties in the state. But their level of political activity and awareness is definitely another phenomena from when we got there in the very early 70s to where we are now in 2015. There was one African-American male that was on the school board. That was the only level of political activity that we saw in Warren County. And for those who don't know, Warren County is right near the Virginia border, kind of between Carr Lake and Gaston Lake.
What are the demographics? What's
it's actually,
or what were they then?
Yeah, I was going to say back then. I'm actually probably more familiar than now, but the population grew out of the fact, the concept of Soul City, I should say, grew out of the fact that my dad, along with T.T. Clayton, our attorney Theocious Clayton, the husband of former Congresswoman Eva Clayton, had looked at this piece of property many years ago before going to CORE as a co-op kind of piece with the Native American populations, the African American population, and whites. So when I got there in about 69-70, there were about, I'd say, almost 70% African Americans. And then the other 30% was Native American and Caucasian. So you could see initially, number-wise, politically, they could have been, you know, have ruled the entire county just from the numbers. But that was not what was happening. So now I'm proud to say, of course, you know, there's a great deal of diversity across the board in the school board, the superintendent, African American sheriff, you name it. I am still active there. I live in what is the home house that my parents built almost 40 years ago. And my husband works for the North Carolina Association of Educators. Ironically, he was just given Warren County as one of his territories to work on. I think they're a little scared of us right now. I was asked to do the commencement speech this past June for Warren County High School, which is, in essence, the equivalent to the high school I would have graduated from many, many moons ago. So in that speech, I kind of called to task. I prayed on it for many, many months, actually, read the speech, because I felt an obligation to tell those children, don't stay here. And it was hard for me to say that, but I also knew in the pit of my soul, you need to leave here to grow and do better and then come back. And I used myself as an example. And I also talked about Soul City in regard to the fact that people that are there now don't understand what kind of commitment that community made and the residuals you're seeing now. And I joked about it, but it's also true. So you go up Interstate 85 and you get to Oxford and you have a Popeyes or, you know, a cookout. You go to Henderson and you've got, you know, Ruby Tuesdays or Smithfield Chicken and Barbecue, whatever the case may be. None of those things would have existed without the Carr Lake Regional Water System. And that credit doesn't go to Floyd McKissick Sr. It actually goes to Evelyn McKissick, my mother, who was the first elected official of Soul City and the chair of the Soul City Sanitary District, which helped to bring the three counties together, Vance, Warren, and Granville County, to have a better water system than we even do right here now in the Triangle. In fact, I just read in the paper a couple of weeks ago with the county commissioners that Warrington, the city of Warrington, will be selling some water to Franklinton because there's that big outgrowth from Wake County.
So tell me more about the vision. You said it was a place where all people can live. It was meant to be integrated. What else about it?
Well, I think there's just been this periodic let me start backwards. My father's vision, from what I understand in talking to him and even from the brochures, talk about how he remembered at the end of World War II and these cities, you know, redeveloping and growing again. And that was kind of the concept originally. But he also wanted a place where African Americans and people of color in general felt at home. You had a place here. Now, it's not, I think, because of the name S-O-U-L-C-I-T-Y, there was always a concept that, oh, it's about all black people, and he doesn't want anybody there. It was never the concept, and as much as he tried to explain that he meant S-O-U-L, not like James Brown, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud, but more about soul as an agape love and soul goal from the Bible. So I think we envisioned it as several small units with cul-de-sacs within those, where each little village, per se, would have, you know, so many houses with its own elementary, maybe middle school, shopping center area. And so it would be, we drew off of some of the things learned from the new towns back a few decades previous, so Reston, Virginia, and, of course, Columbia, Maryland.
Right. So, and it didn't really grow that way. And I think when people talk about it and you say you take umbrage when they call it a failure, that's what they're pointing to.
It
didn't end up looking like that. But talk more about the political legacy because, I mean, number one, there's your mother's sort of insistence on clean water and sanitation, which that now makes it a model. What are some of the other ways that you think this changed the politics of the area?
Even now, ironically, I serve on the Warren County Parks and Recreation Commission just as a volunteer, a citizen volunteer. But my goal in doing that is to look after and make sure that it's preserved and maintained the Magnolia Ernest Recreational Complex, which is still, after almost 40 years, the only public swimming pool in Warren County. It's named after my father's parents, Ernest and Magnolia McKissick, And we have a tennis court, basketball courts, a playground. Warren County, quite frankly, had not seen anything like that. We now, because I'm on the commission, of course, I work for the entire county, we try to have a little bit. It is a very, very large county, one of the largest counties in the state of North Carolina, landmass-wise. And so it is kind of difficult to get everything to the area. So even now, though, as I say, if you go to Warren County to find some place where you think you might want to develop, Soul City is the destination, as presented by the Economic Development Commission, as pretty much the only place in Warren County. I won't say the only, but the infrastructure
there's
is
enough
there.
The infrastructure
is there, and that is not true of most of the rest of that county. So if you want to come and pretty much like sit down and get going right away, you pretty much are going to be in Soul City. And doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, but it did had up until probably about 10 years ago a healthcare facility which was prorated based upon income. Prior to health coexisting, there was only one black doctor in a three-county area. It's kind of hard to imagine.
You know, we talk about the insults you face, the resistance, and all of the things that made it more difficult. And we think, how can you imagine a time? But I'm wondering now if it's that hard to imagine, or if we're not somehow revisiting that period. I mean, I'm wondering how you're feeling about things today.
Ironic you should ask me today. Today is my mother's birthday, and as the youngest of four, I think I probably knew my parents a little bit better. You know, that last one kid around the house, you just kind of hear and feel. And yesterday in class, well, I had about 5 minutes extra my first day of class, and I actually decided I'd put something up there just in case I had the time to play it. And I played a song, and I told them it's my anthem right now because this is the way I feel. It is a new release by an artist called Janelle Monae, and she has a grouping of artists called Wonderland. And the name of the song is Hell You Talking About. And it's a drum beat in the background. And that's all we say. Say their name, Michael Brown. Say their name. So for me, I look back at the struggles and desegregation and what I consider to be a little bit of maybe trauma in my personal individual life here or there. But I look around and I have two young black men that are my sons. And I worry for their safety. They have known since little kids, as a single parent, I used to say, if you're ever stopped, you say, yes, sir. You put your hands out the window. I mean, I hate the fact that I had to teach them. I used to leave the house in Kentucky when I was working on my PhD and say, don't let someone give you a reason to call you the N-word. Unfortunately, I had to do that. I needed my young black men to grow up to be men as opposed to boys. So I do think this country, yes, we have Barack Obama as the president of the United States. It is not a post-racial society. Every day I run into something and I think, did this happen to me because I'm an African-American, because I'm female, because I still question those kind of things. I mean, racism is not dead. Sexism is not dead. Homophobiaism is not dead. They're all related because they all are based out of the same level of hatred. And so until we as a people really just begin to look, I think as my dad was trying to convey with the Soul City concept of humanity and not the color of your skin. I even say this all the time. I tell Jesse Jackson, I'm using one of his favorite lines. I say it frequently for many, many issues, and I mean it. It's not a matter of black or white. The issue is wrong or right. It's just very basic.
We've had hundreds of years to work this out, and certainly intensely over the last 50, 60 years, where it's been a conscious, overt conversation. We've made much progress, and the conversation has been had. You use the word hate, but you have to know somebody to hate them. And the way racism works in the society, it's quite anonymous. It's quite, but also deliberate. You can't see the number of people shot down in the street unarmed without thinking there isn't something systemic behind it. I don't mean intentional. I don't mean conspiratorial. But it has to be other than passion and hatred. What are the systems at work here that keep this thing going well beyond when anybody wants it to operate in our system?
I was watching the news this morning, and I thought, the case is being deliberated today in Charlotte about the police officer shooting 10 times the unarmed African-American man who happened to have an automobile accident. And then a few minutes later, I see the Confederate flag, and it's this state of North Carolina, and somebody riding around in the back of a truck. And I wonder, how do I reach those people? How do I touch them so that they will want to think about things from a different perspective? I don't know anymore. I know I still want to do that. I know I still talk to as many people as possible. There's kind of a joke, no matter where I've worked. And, oh, yes, doesn't matter if she has tenure or not. Her mouth will runneth. She will speak the truth. She will speak what she believes to be the truth. And when she sees an injustice, she will speak up. I do think that's something that doesn't happen quite as much as maybe happened in the 70s or, you know.
Well, when
it's
you talk,
though
when
we just kind of, you know, hear a dirty joke or, you know, a racist comment and we let it slide. I'm the kind of individual that will step up and say, I'm so sorry, so-and-so. I did not find that offensive. Could you explain to me why you find that humor? And I actually would want to have a conversation to help us move from one place to the other. In fact, that's one of the reasons that my pet project, I only pick a few, but my biggest pet project right now is working with the Pauli Murray board. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on that, and I was recently appointed to the Duke Center for Documentary Studies. But my heart is with Pauli Murray Project because it's all the same social justice, human justice issues we're talking about that crosses kind of a whole bunch of different right. barriers.
What about your students at North Carolina Central? How are they feeling? Are they beyond, you know, is their frustration beyond hope, or is there a sense that they want to get engaged as well?
I think I've got both.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I was having a conversation about some brand new sneakers, tennis shoes that came out, and they had chains on the end. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but they looked like shackles. Mm. Okay, and so we had this great debate, and one of my students, who I consider to be a very bright guy, we're Facebook friends right now. I really like him. He's really very creative. He did not see a problem with that at all. But I'd say 90% of the class said the first thing I thought of were slave ships and da-da-da-da-da. So I think I have a level of consciousness within my classes at North Carolina Central that are still diverse. Certainly Black Lives Matter is a big, big issue on our campus, absolutely. Probably on any campus, but certainly in HBCU. I think that most of them are trying to figure a way to make things better. They're not quite sure. They don't quite have the direction from folks. In fact, I get frequently, what would you, Dr. Mack, about blah, 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 blah. Of course, I'm always usually not so much about the nonviolence, but perhaps civil direct obedience and questioning those in power. I've never been exactly loved by administration, no matter where I've worked, because I've asked some of those tough questions upon occasion.
Charmaine, what a pleasure to talk with you. So great to spend this time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Charmaine McKissick-Melton is a professor of mass communication at North Carolina Central University. You can find out more about her and her career at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director, Al Wodarski sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.